Ladies and gentlemen, start your engines. It's time to get revved up for sports, sports, and guess what? More sports on the RPM Roundtable Podcast with Robin Clark, Paul McGaughey, and Mike Sesney.
So this is episode 10 of the RPM Roundtable Podcast. We've made it to double digits. The last time you heard from us, we were getting chased out of here by a fire alarm. I'm Paul McGaughey. I'm here with Robin Clark and Mike Sesney, also known as the Notorious Sez. Now, Robin, do you have any nickname? Do you have a nickname?
Not really, no.
I don't have a nickname either. And it's not really the kind of thing you can appoint to yourself. So we'll just see if anything kind of unfolds as the year goes along. But for now, we're just Robin and Paul. Lots to talk about today. Let's start with the Toronto Maple Leafs, who lost 5-2 last night to Tampa Bay. I know the Leafs have already clinched a playoff spot, but that was still an important game for them because there's still an opportunity for them to win their division, jump up to number two, and have home ice advantage in the first round. However, they experimented a bit with their lineup last night. They normally play one of their tough guys, either Colton Orr or Fraser McLaren. Last night with their third line, they went with more of a skilled line. How do you guys feel about this? Is that the right time to be experimenting?
Yeah, I think so, given that there's three games left in the season. And I think during the playoffs, if somebody goes down injured, these guys have all been sitting up in the press box for a few weeks now. So I think just getting their legs some ice time and having the opportunity to play a bit. And I also think in the playoffs that if there's a team that they play that isn't necessarily a team that's going to be fighting every period, I think some of these guys might check into the lineup over Fraser McLaren or Colton Orr. But, I mean, it'll be up to Randy Carlyle, the lineup they ice, obviously. But I think it's good to have Colburn go out there and actually have some skating time, considering he's not a very good skater in the first place.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. You mentioned that if they don't play a very tough team or something in the first round, Montreal, right? I mean, you don't need Colton Orr and Fraser McLaren because of Brandon Prust. One of those guys is sufficient. Mark Fraser can take him on. And so, yeah, I'm fine with it. I also think that, yeah, it was a bad loss, and it would have been nice to make a run at the division. I'm not sure that's realistic now. They would need to win their final two games, and Boston would have to lose their final three. So with the loss last night, I think any chances of that are kind of gone. In the next couple of games, they play Florida tonight. I don't want to say it doesn't matter, because if they slip to 7th or 8th and get stuck playing Pittsburgh or Boston, I don't think that's a good matchup for them. But they do well at least to beat Montreal on Saturday. Not to look too far ahead, but
yeah, I actually would like to see them win out their final two games and maybe take home ice away from at least Montreal, kind of slip into that 4 seed. But again, that's just wishful thinking, I think. And at this point, I would like to see them kind of work on their conditioning towards the playoffs, and this might be a good opportunity for Randy Carlyle to kind of build that playoff type coaching style now, as opposed to waiting until they start playing the first round of the playoffs. This might be an opportunity to start getting those systems that he wants them to play in the playoffs, the line changes, the matchups, the minutes that everybody's going to be playing. I think it's a good time to kind of experiment and get the team on track with that.
For the casual fan that has watched the Leafs this season, can they expect a drastic style and change of play in the playoffs?
I think so. I think their hits, obviously we were talking about this before we started recording, their hits are a number that really pops out. And I think that without the fighting, the hits are sufficient enough to bruise and beat up a team like Montreal, and hopefully open up some space for the smaller forwards, the guys that can put the puck in the net, like Kessel and Kadri and whoever, even though Kadri himself is a pretty good forechecker. So
yeah, I think you know, stick with what got you here. I think that they'll play the same style they have all season. It's been really successful. If they're matched up against, I don't know, say they slip into the sixth seed and they face Washington, you got to hit Ovechkin to contain him. You can't outgun Washington necessarily. And against Montreal, we've seen it in the two games that they've really beat up on the Habs. You got to check them, you got to fight them, you got to do all that kind of stuff. And so I think the style that they've been playing all season will be effective for them in the playoffs.
Yeah, and I don't know how much to read into this, but I think now this is kind of making itself apparent to me, is that Washington is a similar team to Tampa Bay. So I'm wondering if the Leafs iced a lineup similar to what they would play against a Washington lineup, given that they're not a very rugged team by any means, and they have a fast sniper, much like Stamkos and Ovechkin. And I wonder if they're going to ice a lineup that can skate a bit better against Washington in the playoffs. So maybe that was a bit of a test or something like that, or rather to see how the team would perform with that kind of a lineup.
Now, speaking of Washington, they started off the year 2-11. They bounced back quite nicely and actually clinched their division. They now sit with 26 wins, 18 losses, and two overtime losses. What do you guys, did you notice anything from them after their slow start that allowed them to get back to where they are?
Ovechkin. He picked it up. He was pretty much a non-factor, as you mentioned, with their really poor start, and there were all kinds of questions about whether he was done, and obviously people have been saying for the past few years that he hasn't been the same since he got crushed at the Olympics, but he's not making headlines like he should be considering his output this year. He's been fantastic for them. Obviously, they're in a division with a bunch of really bad teams. All you need to do is look at the standings, and you see Carolina in 13th, Tampa in 14th, and Florida in 15th. It's all the Southeast Division, and the Jets are in 9th. And so I think that, yeah, it's Ovechkin's carried them. And
yeah, I actually think, too, it's like it's more also the role players, like Troy Brouwer has started to step up and be a leader for them. And Mike Ribeiro, obviously coming over last year, he's had a pretty good season so far as well, offensively. And they're getting goaltending, too. And I think Braden Holtby's been starting for them again. Yeah. And he was obviously on their playoff run there last year. So it's good to see that they're doing well. They're the team that should win that division. And this will be actually, they're the last ever Southeast Division champs.
That's right, because of the realignment.
Yeah, because of the realignment, yeah.
So there's one more note that I want to get to in the Eastern Conference, and then we'll talk a little bit about the West. Every year there's a possibility that Pittsburgh and Washington can meet in the playoffs. Obviously you have Ovechkin and Crosby, who arguably are the two biggest stars in the game and guys that the NHL tries to market. Yet when those teams face, obviously one of those teams is gone. Right, and I always think that's a huge loss for the playoffs once one of those teams is out.
Yeah, and given actually this year that the Flyers aren't in it, so you don't have that Pittsburgh or the Pennsylvania rivalry, which actually had probably one of the most entertaining playoff series I've watched in a pretty long time last year.
Every game was 7-5, yeah.
Yeah, it was very entertaining. And, I mean, now I guess if the Rangers hold on to the eighth spot and play Pittsburgh, then you get that matchup as well. So I don't know. I hear you though for sure, because it seems kind of funny last year when Pittsburgh and Philly played, and at the feeling you had was, wow, how entertaining is this hockey? And then once it's over, you know nothing's going to top that the rest of the way. So it was kind of sucks to get it out of the way the first round, and then you don't have much to look forward to, but hopefully, it's, you know, new rivalries always start in the playoffs. That's how rivalries start. So,
and you mentioned just about the potential first-round matchup against the Rangers. Just so everyone knows, the scenario basically is that the Jets need to win tonight their final game of the season. They're at home against Montreal, and then hope the Rangers lose their final two games or only pick up a single point in their final two games, because the Jets would finish with more regulation and overtime wins than the Rangers if they were only to pick up 1 point. And potentially, I don't see this happening, they could get up to seventh if Ottawa loses their final game, their final three games. But basically for Winnipeg, they need to take care of business tonight to even have a chance.
So. Yeah, and given the way Montreal has been playing, I don't think they should have too much trouble.
No, no, not at all. I got the chronic by the tree. I love it when you call me Big Papa. Throw your hands in the air if you's a true player. I love it when you call me Big Papa. To the honeys, get your money, play your fellas like dummies.
So there's been a lot of talk the past couple weeks about the Detroit Red Wings, who right now are on the playoff bubble. They currently sit in eighth. But if they were to miss the playoffs, I believe it's been 20 years since they were last out of the playoffs.
Yep.
But it looks like they're battling and may end up with that eighth spot.
I think they're going to make it in for sure. It's hard. I mean, like you said, it's hard to imagine a playoffs without Detroit in it. And I just think that I think Columbus is for real, but I just don't think that they're ready to make that next step yet. And it just seems like Detroit has been in these situations before, and they have the experience behind them to get through this and make the playoffs. And I think the team that's really kind of flopping right now is Minnesota, and that would be absolutely horrible for them to miss the playoffs, given what they did in the offseason, spending so much money. And, yeah, I mean, I think Detroit will be in there.
Well, Minnesota, as you were mentioning, they're the only team in the top eight in either conference who has a negative goal differential. So they've been sort of playing with fire for a while now. And I'm with Mike on this. I think they'll finish seventh, and ultimately Columbus will miss out. It was a good story while it lasted, but nothing more than that.
Let's scroll down and look at the bottom of the Western Conference standings, where you have Colorado in 15th, Nashville in 14th, Edmonton in 13th, Calgary in 12th. And Robin, I know you're amazed at just, I guess, how bad Colorado is.
Well, I mean, Colorado is a young team, and I wasn't expecting much out of them. But what amazes me is that Edmonton, who everyone thought had maybe the best chance of the Canadian teams who are outside of the playoffs to make it in. And somehow Calgary, who blew up their team and everyone was saying had a great chance to finish last, is actually ahead of the Oilers. And it seems every single year, oh, this is the year for the Oilers. This is the year for the Oilers. And I said this at the beginning of the year. I didn't have them making the playoffs. I said that signing an offensive defenseman and Justin Schultz would do absolutely nothing, because that's not where they needed to improve. And drafting Yakupov was also a huge mistake. And he's mostly been disappointing, I think, and making headlines for the wrong reasons. And so, I mean, I don't know what's next for this team, but I hadn't been paying that close attention to the standings, at the bottom at least. And I can't believe that Edmonton is only 4 points ahead of Colorado in last place.
Yeah, I also didn't have them making the playoffs, and for me it was goaltending mostly. And I don't know how everybody thought that they were going to make the playoffs with Devan Dubnyk and Nikolai Havi-Bulin, who's drunk 95% of the time anyways and driving.
Always a good combination.
Yeah, and it's like now they're tanking again all of a sudden, and Nashville's trying their best not to tank, apparently. And they would probably do themselves a pretty good favor in tanking and picking up Nathan MacKinnon, who might save their franchise, given that they need that star player around their franchise to actually draw people to come to their games. And, Edmonton's just so funny in the way that they just keep tanking every year, and they pick up the same player. They always pick up that small forward, superstar player, and they have a whole team of these guys now. And they have no role players. And, well, I mean, they have a couple, obviously, but...
Yeah, Ryan Jones.
Yeah, and Mike Brown. And, yeah. But they need defense, like a shutdown D-man. So, I mean, I guess they're tanking and they're going to try and get Seth Jones. But we'll see where this goes. I'm interested of what's going to happen in Edmonton, but
and to me that's totally nuts. Getting a young defenseman who's not going to be—I'm not saying Jones isn't going to be good, but he's not going to be an immediate shutdown defenseman to make.
Yeah.
Like I would have traded the pick last year, and I surely would trade the pick this year.
Yeah, especially when defensemen don't really enter their prime until they're around 26 anyway.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
But I don't know. It just seems and. Nobody believed me when I said this, but I was always under the impression that there will be a time when Edmonton needs to sign all of these young players when all of their rookie contracts expire, and they're going to want a ton of money. They'll want Tavares money, what Kadri will probably get this year, and that's around $5 million, $6 million with inflation given, whatever. They're not going to be able to re-sign all these guys, and they're just going to have to keep blowing it up at the end of the cycle of this RFA or whatever, these guys' rookie contracts expire.
And I'd just like to point out a stat that I saw a few days ago. With the Leafs making the playoffs, Edmonton now has the longest playoff drought at 2,502 days. So there you go.
Now, in our class, we obviously have Leafs fans, we have Canadiens fans, Senators fans, Canucks fans, and Oilers fans. So anytime we have these conversations, someone's feelings are probably going to get hurt.
That's good. That's the way it should be.
Yeah, definitely. No Calgary fans, though.
No, I'm not surprised. No Jay Feaster fans out there?
We're back on the RPM Roundtable podcast. We're going to take a look around Major League Baseball. Let's start in the National League with the Braves. I think we all pretty much knew that they would be battling with the Washington Nationals for the division title in the East. At this point, it's early, but Atlanta looks to be running away with it. I remember saying, Robin, that they were, on paper, they look like a solid team all around, and that is proving to be the case.
Yeah, definitely. Atlanta has been absolutely amazing, and as I was saying, looking at the standings, they're running away with the division considering that Washington isn't even 500 anymore. They've got a 4-game lead on the Mets and a 5-game lead on Washington. They also just got Freddie Freeman, their first baseman, back from the disabled list. Jason Hayward, their right fielder, wasn't hitting and is now injured, but once he gets it together, they're going to start scoring a ton of runs. And keep in mind, this is all without any kind of solid production from BJ Upton and a whole season without Brian McCann. So, I mean, I said that it would come down to the Braves and Nationals, but they're running away with it.
Yeah, they're actually, their on base plus slugging right now is 772, which is a pretty high number, only being beat by Colorado right now, who is on fire, and their OPS at 820. I think Atlanta, just they have that perfect combination of pitching and hitting, and their pitching rotation might be, like Robin said, I think in the preview, one of the best since they had Smoltz and
Glavin,
yeah, back in 92, 93. And, yeah, it's, I mean, Atlanta's funny. They have that really, really, like I said, solid combo. And you just wonder if the Nationals have the lineup to kind of match that. I know Adam LaRoche has been struggling pretty mightily for the Nationals so far. Their pitching, obviously, has still been dynamite. Their closer, Rafael Soriano, has been lights out for them. But, I mean, Kimbrel. Okay, here's an interesting argument for you. Who would you take in this scenario? Soriano or Kimbrel as your closer?
Kimbrel.
Yeah.
For sure.
So, I don't know. It would be interesting to put the two lineups together beside each other and kind of see who has the advantage where. But I think bullpen wise, I would definitely take the Braves, and the rotation would be a close one if you ask me.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. But it's interesting to note Washington scored the ninth fewest runs in the league. They've only scored 76 runs this season. And obviously Harper has been amazing. But outside of that, they're not really getting a lot from anyone else. Jason Worth is not hitting. Espinoza and Ian Desmond aren't even close to doing what they did last year. And so, I mean, I expect them to pick it up. They're not going to be a 500 team, but yeah, they need to pick it up, or Atlanta is going to have that division locked up.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those divisions too. If you get behind by 10 games or so, it could be Washington fighting for a wild card spot as opposed to the division.
For
there.
Sure.
Anything else strike you guys in the National League right now?
Yeah, the Rockies. It's them somehow winning a lot, as well as the Mets putting together a pretty good start to their year. They're getting a lot of production from guys that you wouldn't normally expect a lot of production out of.
John Buck has been
John
impressive.
Buck, yeah. I mean, it's funny. It seems like every time the Jays make a trade with a catcher, Mike Napoli.
Oh, God.
And now John Buck, it seems they go on to have some sort of all-star season.
And speaking of Buck, anytime Aaron Sebia seems to slump, and obviously he's not right now, but, you know, if he goes 0 for 4 and then 0 for 3, you see a few moronic tweets. Oh, yeah, the Jays traded the wrong catcher in the offseason. And it's like, my God.
Yeah, well, I think Buck hit like 150 last year, so it's hard to see. You can't ever... It's hard to prognosticate something like that. That's ridiculous.
Did yeah. you guys see? Sorry, did you see that Darno is hurt?
I did not.
Yeah, I saw that. I mean, obviously, an injury-riddled start to his career has kind of put his debut in the majors on hold for now a couple years. So that's kind of ironic, I guess. I don't know how to put that.
Well, the Jays probably still got the better of the deal. Well, definitely in the short term. And
yeah.
I mean, you can't predict an injury, but when you look at it right now, it's worked out nicely for the Jays, I guess.
Yeah, as long as Dickey can keep that knuckleball dancing.
And we're going to get to the Jays in a few minutes. Looking at the NL, definitely some bad teams. Miami, Chicago, and San Diego are going to battle it out for the worst team in the NL.
Yeah, definitely. No question about that. I also was just noticing there are four teams in the National League Central, the Cardinals, Reds, Pirates, and Brewers, all within a game and a half of each other. And I don't remember the last time there was even a three-way race in a division, never mind a four-way race. And so it's still early. I expect... I don't know, Pittsburgh and Milwaukee to fall off a little bit and St. Louis and Cincinnati to be there at the end, but that could be pretty interesting division to follow over the course of the season.
Yeah, and actually looking also at the NL West, the Dodgers have just been terrible to start this year, and they've spent a lot of money this offseason too. And, I mean, right now they're second last in the National League in runs. They have 64. Only Miami's had less with 54, and the Cubs are ahead of them by one at 65. So they're not in very good company down there, given that their lineup and rotation's actually pretty talented, and having similar struggles, I guess, as the Blue Jays are right now, kind of putting together all the pieces to have a winning formula, which is kind of funny in a sport like baseball that's so it seems so individual, but. When the whole team's not hitting, it really sticks out. And guys like Ethier are just having really off starts to the year. So,
I just wanted to say about the Dodgers. Obviously, as you were mentioning, they've gotten off to a terrible start. Two nights ago, Matt Kemp hit his first double of the season, and last night he got his first home run of the season. So, I think they're starting to wake up. Obviously, they lost last night on. A pretty crazy play. The manager, Don Mattingly, intentionally walked Lucas Duda, and the next guy hit a grand slam, which is the ultimate thing, you know, saying we don't respect you enough to pitch to the guy before you. We think we're going to get you out, and then he cranks one out to win the game. So,
yeah,
But I think the Dodgers will pick it up. If Matt Kemp gets hot, then look out NL West.
Which Mattingly didn't really do anything wrong. He was playing the proper matchup there.
For sure.
But, I mean, you get the guy like Valdespin. He hasn't hit a home run yet all year, and his first one, you know, has to be that walk-off grand slam. So yeah. Good for him, I guess.
When we return, we're going to take a look at the American League.
I think y'all having a good time out there.
I have a couple notes that I want to mention in the American League before we talk specifically about the Blue Jays. One thing that stood out to me was that the Detroit Tigers welcomed back Jose Valverde as their closer. And Mike, maybe you want to just give a little bit of history behind that move.
Yeah, so last year in the playoffs, obviously Valverde wasn't very clutch for the Detroit Tigers. Closing out games, and this year he was a free agent, so the Detroit Tigers opted not to re-sign Valverde and decided to maybe run with their rookie closer, Bruce Rondon, which also didn't really work out for them. So they've been doing a kind of a closer by committee type deal to start the year, which has worked out okay. A couple occasions it has not. So they decided to re-sign Mr. Valverde, and I don't know how Valverde feels. It's kind of like the ex-girlfriend that wasn't good enough for you, but then you couldn't get anybody else, so you're bringing her back after you tested the market a bit.
If I can just jump in quickly, he didn't even pitch in the World Series, is that correct? They lost so much confidence in him that they shut him down after the AL Championship Series?
And, so he got a save last night, too. So it's kind of funny how that all worked out. But I guess Valverde's back. We'll see how he does. They have a lot of good arms in the back end of their bullpen. So, whatever happens. I was really hoping, for my fantasy team's sake, that they would give Al Albuquerque a shot. But that never really happened. So I blame our good friend Rami for giving me that fantasy advice.
And I actually saw Valverde's save, and I think he had one of the quickest innings ever. He only took about 15 minutes to throw his 10 pitches, so that was good to see. I was really happy when the Jays didn't sign him. He has his crazy antics on the mound.
Yeah, it takes an hour to finish out the ninth inning.
Yeah, it's so annoying.
I guess the mindset of a closer is finicky, right? Like, what happens? Like, last year, apparently, he's lost it, and now he has it back.
I don't know if he has it back as much as they wanted a closer instead of saying, okay, if it's a left-hander, we're going to use Phil Koch, and if it's a right-hander, we might use Benoit, or we might use Dotel, or we might use... I mean, you can't do that, because then it gets messy, and then people start questioning, well, why didn't you use this guy? Why didn't you use that guy? In this case, you just say, okay, this one guy's our closer. We have a lead in the ninth. You're in.
Yeah, and there was a similar situation, actually, with the Blue Jays a few years back when Cito Gasson was here. There was no clear defined roles in the bullpen, and you didn't know who he was going to trot out there in the ninth to save the game. And it was kind of a headache, and it was just, I mean, as a manager, you get questioned about everything you do, and when it comes to those situations, you either look like a genius or you look like a complete moron, which kind of leads me into my next point. Watching the Jays game last night, I don't know. This is the first time I've kind of questioned a John Gibbons move so far this year, was when they left the lefty pitcher Aaron Loop in to face Manny Machado with two outs there. I think it was in the eighth inning.
Yep.
And obviously Machado scored the tying run for the Orioles there that sent it to extras. I just thought you have eight guys in the bullpen, and why not use the righty there in that matchup? Because Machado's been killing lefties with runners in scoring position so far this year.
Yeah, that's where you'd think you'd have a guy like Steve Delabar or whoever.
Yeah,
come in and
face one hitter.
Well, I know that the Jays, their bullpen has been used, I think, almost more than any other team in the league this year. Maybe that has something to do with it. The arms just aren't fresh.
It could, I mean, but and I understand that he wants to save the arms for this series this weekend with the Yankees. But, I mean, get the win. They've been struggling so hard to get wins all year. Why not just do it?
Yeah, for sure. And I just wanted to, you were mentioning about bullpen mismanagement on the part of the Jays. Baltimore's closer, Jim Johnson, who had that totally ridiculous season last year, he appeared in all three games of the series and threw 51 pitches total, 24 yesterday. And if you guys don't follow me on Twitter, first of all, do. It's at RobC416. And I've been getting chirped by a lot of Orioles fans. I got my tweet answered by Buster Olney, basically saying, I was saying, like, how are the Orioles going to be good? So much went right for them last year, blah, blah, blah. And I was basically told that, oh, Buck Showalter is a genius and blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, 51 pitches in three games by your closer, if that's not complete bullpen mismanagement, then I don't know what is.
Now, let's look a little bit at the Jays going forward. They pick up an exciting win yesterday. A couple miraculous plays highlighted by Rajai Davis's throwout at the plate to preserve the tie in extra innings. I remember actually a couple weeks ago when we had our last show, the Jays had squeaked out a victory against Detroit, and we thought, okay, maybe this is the one that gets them going. It didn't. They have kind of a similar victory yesterday. Will this finally get them going?
I'm going to take the wait-and-see approach because there's been two occasions now that I've thought that, and it hasn't really turned out that way. I thought overall this series against the Orioles, though, I thought was kind of the one positive you could take out of it is that they were in every game. They didn't get blown out by any means, and they did almost pick up two out of three, but I mean, moral victories, like R.A. Dickey said, don't count in the win column. So, I don't know. We'll see. I guess we'll see tonight. It's a big series, too.
Yeah, and all three games, as you mentioned, were one-run games. And just going back to the Orioles, they obviously had the crazy records last year in one-run games when leading after the seventh, extra innings, blah, 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 and people were saying, well, look, they're a good character team and whatever, and I think that kind of stuff is nonsense, and it was just a statistical anomaly, and you look at them now, and they're 4-4, as you would expect, in 2013 in one-run games. So,
yeah, I think one of the things that sticks out for me a lot for the Blue Jays, and I know it's been talked about quite a bit, is the 0-2 approach. They're all, and the fact that every single hitter on the Blue Jays team, I don't know why, but they all think that they're going to hit a home run at every at-bat. And I understand they hit a lot of home runs and whatever. You can say, oh, well, that's how you get offense. But when you're not getting anybody on base for these home runs and they're all solo shots, they don't really amount to that much. And it's just, it also leads to high strikeouts and not very good on-base percentage for the team. I mean, the leader in on-base percentage right now is Adam Lind, given that Jose Reyes is not playing. And, I mean, he's actually gotten on base quite a bit, and obviously yesterday he wasn't playing. He's not doing so well in batting average right now, and I think it's positive that he's getting on base now a lot, because I think if you're seeing the ball well, the hits are going to come, but he needs to be a guy that's hitting doubles and extra base hits for them, home runs, and that's what he's there to do. I don't want to see him get walked and then chug his way to second base and thrown out a double play or whatever he does. He's not a fast guy on the base pass by any means. So,
and if people have been thinking that the Jays are striking out a lot, you'd be totally right. J.P.R. and Sebia and Colby Rasmus have each struck out 32 times, and that's tied for second in the league behind only Chris Carter of the Houston Astros. And just to put it into perspective, JP has a 32-2 strikeout to walk ratio, and Rasmus isn't much better at 32-5. And yeah, it's horrible. When you hit home runs, you're gonna strike out, but you at least need to walk some of the time too.
Well, here's the alarming number, really. Or the alarming fact, J.P. Arencibia leads the team in batting average right now, 268, and he's like a career 230 hitter. So having a guy like that leading the team in batting average is just, with a team that features some pretty good players, that's alarming for sure. It's, I mean, Encarnacion is hitting home runs too, and his batting average is slowly creeping up. I see he got over the Mendoza line yesterday. So I don't know. Maybe it's time that they're finally coming around, but I don't know. We'll see.
As the Jays head into New York for a four-game series this weekend, I just want to conclude by talking a little bit about Vernon Wells. I felt that in the series last weekend at the Rogers Center, he looked like an all-star. And if I want one thing to happen in this series, it's for him to get shut down and for him to strike out a lot.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure he could have had a better series. I believe he was 7-for-14 with two home runs in the series in Toronto. And so, yeah, I think he'd be hard-pressed to do better, but that was hard to watch, especially, too, never mind the two home runs. Like, he did hit a decent number of home runs in Toronto, and even with the Angels, I think he hit 25 a couple of years ago. But that catch that he made on Encarnacion against the cage in the bullpen was unbelievable, and it was like shades of Vernon Wells in 2008 when he was winning gold gloves playing center in Toronto. And yeah, they got to find a way to shut him down and shut down the whole Yankees offense, because if you're not going to win a whole bunch of games, you got to at least take care of business within your own division.
I just think it won't be too long until he's hitting like 150 again, and he's going to be the Vernon Wells we all saw last year in Anaheim. Unless, of course, he is touching that Yankee magic somehow, that they always manage to pull these players out of complete obscurity and they all play above their heads.
And I think it also helps, too, that they have their, you know, Little League World Series dimensions 314 yeah. feet down the line. I mean, that's a flyout in 29 other parks. So
yeah, it's even a flyout in the Rogers Center, which is
great hitter's park. Yeah.
So I just have one word of advice for any Jays fan that's heading down to New York this weekend to watch the series. Don't chirp Vernon Wells.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it seems to fuel him a little bit. But you can throw paper airplanes at him. I don't have to. With a fistful of dollars, and baby, you better
believe I'm back in the New York. Thank you for listening to the RPM Roundtable Podcast.